It's the 5th of November, and it's episode 164 of the Security Weekly News. Wrap-up show today for the week of 31 October 2021. War driving, Linux kernels, Pegasus, DarkSide, Breaktooth, Clippy, and more on Security Weekly News Wrap-up.
This is Security Weekly. For security professionals, by security professionals.
We interrupt our program to bring you an important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week. Your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
Every 11 seconds, there's a new ransomware attack. Oil pipelines, universities, corporations, all paying millions of dollars. Barracuda says, don't pay the ransom. Before a ransomware attack occurs, train your teams to recognize an attack and use anti-phishing technology. Protect your applications, and they can't get onto your network. Simple backup and restore solutions quickly recover your data without paying the ransom. Build your ransomware protection plan now by visiting securityweekly.com/Barracuda. That's securityweekly.com/Barracuda.
All right, I'm Doug White, and this is Security Weekly News Wrap-Up Show. On Application Security Weekly number 172, John and Mike had Peter Klimek, the Director of Technology Office of the CTO at Imperva. Peter is on to talk about the challenges he's hearing from customers currently, which I always like to hear that kind of stuff too, because I think you get a lot of information from hearing what other people are experiencing, and it can certainly help you, you know, fix your own security strategies. They were talking about managing an API and what kind of things that we're going to have to do in the coming years. And I think API and supply chain is one of the big threats that everybody's going to face. Pretty heavy, pretty much forwards and I'm going to say backwards too, because a lot of that if you've got software that you're using and it uses APIs and or other products built into it, you know, that's going to be a pretty interesting time. On Business Security Weekly number 238, Ben, Jason, and Matt talk with Kyle McNulty, the founder and host at Secure Ventures. This segment was talking about cybersecurity and its place in the growth cycle relative to startups. So if you're trying to do a startup or you have a small company, because one of the places I think security has really been neglected over the years is in small biz startups, because they can't afford it. You know, I mean, I've done a lot of consulting with small businesses and startups. I often didn't get paid for doing that kind of stuff. But sometimes I got paid, but sometimes, you know, they'd be like, sorry, we can't afford to pay you. But it's really challenging if you're there, and you may have just as much exposure, especially if you're in that transition between, you know, we just started and all of a sudden we got 10,000 customers, you know, successful startup. The segment was mostly about the key strategies you can use to inject cyber into a small company. So how do you actually get there? And, you know, if you don't have massive piles of cash to throw around. In the second segment, 10 questions great bosses ask themselves. Most of those questions for me are, how great am I? 5 cybersecurity personality traits for a successful career. 3 security priorities to support the new hybrid workplace. And of course, they have always a lot of other news as well. On Enterprise Security Weekly 249, Adrian, Katie Taitler, and Tyler Shields had Chad Skipper, the director of product marketing at VMware, on to talk about a recent test exercise that SE Labs did for a network detection and response test against NSX NDR. So this, if you're using VMware, you're interested in VMware, or even if you're just interested in virtualization, probably a pretty good segment to check out, because there's a lot going on there, and whether it's your cloud, AWS stuff, or whatever, even if you're not just using VMware. In the second segment, Frank McGovern, the cybersecurity architect at StoneX Group, Inc., joined the team and was talking about blue teams, and in particular, how blue teams relate to the overall security policy, despite getting a bad rap in terms of people wanting to be blue teamers. I don't think I've ever had anyone, literally, I don't think I've ever had anyone come up and say, my dream is to be a blue teamer, literally. I've had tons of people come up and say, I want to be a red teamer. How do I get there? But I've never had anybody say, I want to be on the blue team. It's kind of like no one wants to be a bass player. You know, it just kind of happens. Like, you know, you're never sort of sitting there and like, you know, middle school saying, man, someday I'm going to be a bass player. I'm sorry, bass players. I mean, a lot of great bass players. And of course, there's Bootsy. I mean, you know, Bootsy makes everybody want to be a bass player, or at least everybody wants to be Bootsy. I don't know. But Bootsy made me want to be a bass player. On the third segment, Leica raises $35 million in growing compliance as a service segment. IBM launches XDR. CrowdStrike acquired Secure Circle and moves into the data layer. Help Systems acquired endpoint dip vendor Digital Guardians. Crazy valuations, questionable statistics. Analysts shine a doubtful light on Dark Trace's value. Facebook gets all meta on us, and more news. They had a big news segment there. Good job, Adrian. On Security and Compliance Weekly, number 93, Flea, Jeff, Johanna Baum, and Kate Valentine had Rick McElroy on the show to talk about turnover. Hoo-hoo-wee. And in particular, turnover related to the great resignation that's currently going on. So there's been a lot of, you know, stuff about how a lot of people have been quitting their jobs. They talked about burnout and some steps that you might want to take to prevent losing all your security talent. I've had people call me about this and say, you know, I hire somebody, they're great. We spend a lot of effort finding them, getting them, bring them in, and they stay here 6 months and they move on. And I'm like, yeah, that's, you know, hint, hint, my boss. On the Security Weekly News, number 163, I wore a blue shirt because I was moving, and they packed my Security Weekly official uniform shirts. And Jason Wood talked about sports streaming, and it was a pretty interesting story about pirating stuff that was very old school. And this guy, this is a current story, but it was about something that sounded like way back in the day, you know, with people pirating music and stuff. And but this person got caught because they decided to try to extort Major League Baseball. Yeah, don't mess with Major League Baseball. Come on. On Paul's Security Weekly, number 717, on the permanent new night, Wednesday. First up was Doug Burks, the CEO at Security Onion Solutions. And if you don't know, Doug's also the founder of Security Onion, so that's pretty cool. The segment was about Security Onion's new container-based platform that's now a lot more scalable and flexible than the older version. So great to see Security Onion moving into a container space so that you can, you know, spin up Security Onions and so forth. So check that out. On the second segment, basically a continuation of talking about the Python script that was written to scan default credentials. The project's now got TOML config file formats to store vendor information and standard credentials to test with. Very cool. Whole bunch of fun stuff in this one, bro. And in the third segment, the news, of course. My threat of the week, then, is going to be war driving. Oh, I can't believe I'm even saying that. I couldn't resist it. It was too much fun to pass this story by. Back in the day, this was a real thing. It's still a real thing, but it was a real thing that was a big deal. There was a lot of talk about it and a lot of consulting calls about it. The CEOs called me saying, you know, what does this mean? What do we do? In fact, before war driving, there was war dialing, which was kind of when I got in the space. And there was probably war telegraphing, war heliographing. I don't know. I mean, the Sumerian Empire probably had like war cuneiform attacks or something. But war dialing was just randomly dialing telephone numbers to try and see if a modem answered on the other end. And that was one of the very first kind of pen testy stuff I ever did in my life, was just seeing how many numbers I could dial at the bank and see if any of them had modems. And guess what? They did. War driving, of course, is looking for Wi-Fi signals to exploit, document, I don't know, whatever the right word is. There was a lot of hoopla about this back in the late 90s, early 2000s, and a lot of sweaty prose got written about secret hobo symbols being scrawled on curbs, and, you know, that would tip off hackers to weak sauce inside, and, you know, hobos apparently used to carve and chalk symbols on, you know, fence posts and stuff to indicate that the owner was a sucker, or that they made a nice cherry pie, or had a really big club with nails in it and didn't like hobos one bit. Well, I never once saw a chalked up curb, but I did do war driving. I think everybody in that era did some war driving. I also did war walking, which was quite interesting and got a lot of stares. And I even did war flying in a Cessna 152. No kidding. I had a student propose that as a project and ask if I could fly a plane. And I was like, yep, I just happened to be able to do that. And he was like, you think you could take me up and let us strap this Yagi to the bottom of the plane, which may have been illegal. We just didn't ask, didn't tell. But we flew really slow and low, and actually we're picking up Wi-Fi network. But I mean, back in the day when Marriott was charging $19.95 to access their internet connection, it was pretty easy to whip out the old Yagi. And let me tell you, after 9/11, security did not like my antenna at all. I got asked some weird questions about that. Everything from, is this some kind of sex toy? To which I said, yeah, you don't have one. To, you know, like, is this a weapon? And, you know, I was like, yes, it is. And I didn't say that. Then I wouldn't be talking to you now. I'd be in Guantanamo Bay. But, you know, I mean, you always had to try to find somebody near the hotel that had a Wi-Fi connection that didn't have encryption or a password. And, you know, faster than you can say naked workout guy, you got a free, you know, internet connection that you don't have to pay Marriott for. You do see all kinds of stuff when you're looking out of a hotel window trying to find free Wi-Fi. I actually did consider printing something on this person's hotel or on this person's Wi-Fi because they had a printer I could see, and I would have been able to avoid that lovely 25 cents a page printing fee that they had. I do think I could have gone over there and knocked on the guy's door and talked him into giving me the printout. But anyway, the point of all this in this article was that this week a researcher in Tel Aviv, so this week, notice, I'm not talking about the old days, this week in Tel Aviv, or it probably didn't happen this week, but the article was this week, they were able to war drive and they found tons of networks. Now, which is not surprising. In the old days, you were pretty much just looking for an open node. And apparently there was a chalk mark that meant that. But today, you know, that's not very common because most stuff's set up with passwords. So the researchers set out to see how vulnerable all this stuff was to this war driving approach and was going to try and crack the password, particularly after the researcher realized that people used a lot of things like their telephone numbers as passwords for the Wi-Fi. And since they knew the country code and the area code portions of these addresses, they were using that as a way to dictionary attack or a combo attack where they brute force, you know, use part of it you've known. And they try out things like that. Out of 5,000 hashes that he grabbed in Tel Aviv, then took Hashcat, which again, boy, old school. A Hashcat will allow you to put in predicted components of the password and use dictionary attacks and brute forcing and so forth. This person reported they used rocku.txt, which is a really comprehensive dictionary, and was able to crack 900 hashes out of the 5,000, which actually, because they cracked the hashes, they produced a total of 3,500 cracked passwords out of 5,000. So that's 70% compromise. You know, what's the hobo code for damn, we're screwed. Anyway, my point is that you probably today need to revisit some of this, looking at the security of them both at home and in your enterprise. Some of the earliest audits I did, we found a lot of unsecured and rogue nodes that have been put up. And today, I think the translation of that for the modern age is going to be weak passwords and devices that are either creating meshes and or creating access points into the network. I never tried to crack them back then because there were so many unsecured ones that, you know, we'd find three or four every time we, you know, scanned the building. But if you have these things up, and I'm sure you do, both legitimate ones and rogue ones, not to mention all those meshes and IoT, IIoT and all that stuff, well, you have a problem. A lot of networks don't distinguish wired versus Wi-Fi traffic, and that means that Wi-Fi traffic could be treated as internal and trusted. Ow. So it's not enough to just slap a password on the node and hope for the best. So I think this is going to be another case of both trust issues and password issues to ensure that people aren't getting into the network via the Wi-Fi, which is unmonitored because people always, you know, at least when I was auditing them, people always were like, well, you can't get in this from out of the building, right? And I'm like, well, we got it from the parking lot. And they're like, well, you can't get in the parking lot without a parking pass. And I was like, oh, no, we were in the parking lot across the street. And, you know, they're like, well, yeah, but what, you got some kind of fancy antenna or something? And I was like, not really. I mean, you know, I had a, you know, a Yagi made out of a piece of PVC that, you know, that we built. It wasn't the prize winning Dinty Moore soup can Wi-Fi Yagi, but mine was like a piece of PVC. It was very directional and you could just hold it and turn. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something you should probably keep in mind and put back in your security audit rotation if you're not doing that. And if you're in high density areas where there's, you know, an office building right across the street and, you know, people don't even need to war drive, they or a hotel, they can just be sitting there scanning your building, sit on the couch, war couching or whatever you want to call that. And, you know, so think about it. And now the news. CVE-43267 is a Linux kernel vulnerability that will allow a heap overflow. And it, and that heap overflow can, of course, lead to remote code execution. And whenever you hear RCE, you go, uh-oh. Basically, this is a vulnerability in the transparent inter-process communication. I didn't actually know what that stood for, but I knew what TIPC is, or TIPC. Some people say TIPC, and I always said TIPC, and then I heard somebody say TIPC, and I was like, that's a cooler way to say that. But TIPC is in the kernel. It is not active by default, but it's a module that allows messaging in Linux clusters. And so you may not have it turned on if you're not using clustering or anything like that. But it's designed to allow kernels to talk to other kernels, and in particular, exchanging certificates for this clustering. And of course, this can obviously be used for other things as well, but it's used a lot in clustering, like some of those, you know, when you want to take 15 machines and put them all together. The vulnerability basically means that TIPC, I'm going to keep saying TIPC, can be connected to like a, you know, it can be like a daemon. And then if a user is able to set that up, and they configure it to be accessible on an interface, well, I mean, that's not really something a regular user could do, but this can be done by an unprivileged user. Yeah, no sudo for you. So since everything it receives is a straight main line into the kernel vein, well, you get the idea. So in order to do all this, a heap overflow is, of course, involved. And heap, and this is where the real vulnerability comes from, heap, if you don't recall from your I mean, a lot, I know a lot of you know this stuff, but some people that watch the news don't know what this stuff is, so I'll explain it. But heap is that memory that's used when programs malloc out new space while they're executing, rather than stack memory, which is allocated at compile, in, you know, it's built into the compile startup. So when it runs, that memory gets allocated first, and then this heap memory gets allocated later. So TIPC has a common header format that has a header size allocation, which is pretty standard. And it basically, in this case, it's the length of the message. The problem is that they did an update in September 2020 that lets the size validation sort of slide. And so that means it's not adequately validated, which means you could actually send a longer message and say it was shorter than it really is, which of course creates an overflow state. This is in Linux kernel 5.1 to 5.15. And TIPC's not, like I said, it's not on by default in most major distros. And so it would have to be enabled for an attack to succeed. But if you've got people in your system, they may be able to get to that kind of stuff. This could be part of a chain of events. There is a patch which was released on GitHub earlier this week. I'm not sure exactly which day. And if you're using TIPC, well, you should probably take care of this one. You may not need, or at least check to see if you're using it. You know, kernel bugs are almost worse than bed bugs. And kernel bugs with RCE are definitely worse than bed bugs. But bed bugs are pretty bad. And I used to be a musician, so I stayed in really cheap hotels, and I knew what a bedbug was. Pegasus spyware, or not spyware, depending on who you talk to and which side you want to take, because, you know, everything depends on perspective. Is it spyware? Of course not, or maybe it is. It depends on which side of it you're on. But basically, Pegasus has been in the news quite a bit, and yes, I take a side and say it's probably spyware. This product was made by the NSO group in Israel, and it allows users, that subscribers, to monitor select phones and devices out in the world. Reputedly, according to the company, they only sell their products to governments, military, and law enforcement. And the product is very expensive. But as the late Idi Amin Dada said, genocide? What genocide? Now give me the software before I start genociding. He didn't really say that, and I don't want his ghost after me, so sorry, Idi Amin. If you don't know who Idi Amin was, I'm sure you'll find out. The software does allow tracking of the device, and it also can monitor activities on the phone, like email, text, exfiltration of all that. And it all sends all that back to the home office, where they can turn it over to the benevolent government buying the service, because, you know, no government is ever bad. The software has been tied to attacks on dissidents, activists, and others, as well as the murder of several journalists, the murder of Khashoggi, who was a Washington Post journalist that was brutally murdered because he wrote a lot of stuff about people that didn't like him writing stuff about them. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of questions about the ethics of this and how it's going to be used and so forth. But anyway, the U.S. Commerce Department added NSO Group to its entity list on Wednesday, which basically says that the United States will not trade with the company. They also added the shuddery named Kandiru company, who reputedly makes a product called Devil's Tongue malware to governments, and has been associated with a former NSO group employees. So Kandiru is another offshoot. Some engineers left NSO and formed Kandiru. And if you don't know what a Kandiru fish is, well, you might not want to look that one up. And definitely don't look up bot flies. If you look up bot flies, you're going to be sorry. I promise. Don't look up bot flies. But anyway, the Commerce Department also banned Positive Technology from Russia for being involved with Russian intelligence and the Computer Security Initiative Consultancy in Singapore. NSO said that it was dismayed, I tell you, claiming to have that they have the world's most rigorous human rights and compliance systems in place. The software does keep popping up, though, on enemies of state everywhere. So a lot of journalists and people said, hey, I've got this on my phone. And remember, a terrorist is just a freedom fighter that you haven't met yet. I know I'm cynical. Likely the ban's going to sting a little bit to NSO, but the company will most likely just rebrand. Maybe they'll call themselves Meta. I don't know. And they'll reappear with a new product shortly, and they're back in business. Because guess what? People want stuff like this, and I'm guessing that NSO is not going to slow down or even be probably not even slowed very much by this. Speaking of rebranding, the U.S. government is also after DarkSkyd and all of its many rebrands with a, wait for this, a $10 million reward for information leading to the arrest or identification of members of DarkSkyd. Well, if you want to get people, this is a way to do it. They also offered a $5 million reward for information that leads to the arrest of any individual who attempts to participate in a DarkSkyd-based attack. I don't know. Maybe we all draw straws. Short straw takes credit and goes to jail, and we split the money. I don't know. The rewards apply to all the variants of DarkSkyd, such as Black Matter and other forks of that original product. DarkSkyd had basically claimed they were disbanding after the Colonial Pipeline attack. But, you know, they disbanded and they reemerged later that day. So everybody got their drinks out and went, are we disbanded now? Yes, we're disbanded. All right, now we're called Black Matter. But, you know, so Black Matter has also since shut down since the authorities pretty much got onto that pretty quickly and went after them as well. The money's being allocated under the Organized Crime Rewards Program, which is handled by the State Department. So much like analog crime, the plan is that people will be greedy and rat each other out for cash. It works on organized crime, and, you know, it works on lots of stuff. So it's pretty smart. I know, still cynical. CISA is encouraging patches for Breaktooth, which, if you aren't familiar, that was a story from a bit ago. But Breaktooth is a collection of 16 vulnerabilities that affect commercial Bluetooth stacks. And those stacks are used on 1,400 different chipsets. And that translates to billions of devices. Yeah, billions with a B. The stacks are used in smartphones, toys, IoT, IIoT, Santa's workshop, you name it. If it has Bluetooth, well, these things are probably there. Intel, Qualcomm, Texas Instruments, Cypress, all subject to this. And remember, it may have these chipsets running inside of it, even if it says, you know, a Happy Meal IoT toy on the outside. Dell, MacBooks, iPhones, Surface, Sony. I mean, this list is very lengthy. So anyway, CISA is calling for vendors to issue patches for this collection, but not all the vendors have patches ready. And as we know, patching chipsets, especially secondary chipsets, meaning that they're inside of another device, can result in a lot of calls to the old help desk. So the bugs range from denial of service crashes on the firmware, freezes, and even complete takeovers of the device. So the article has a link to some of the vulnerable devices and their patch status. But as ever, if you can patch, and if not, think about how you're going to mitigate this thing, because Breaktooth is definitely a thing. In the continuing saga of the governor of Missouri versus the cybersecurity community and common sense, the name of the person who revealed that the Missouri teacher's site had flaws in it and was subsequently attacked by the governor as a hacker and criminal was released as cybersecurity professor Shaji Khan at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. The governor now got all worked up about this and called for prosecution to the maximum extent of the law, hanged by the neck until dead, dead, dead. He didn't say that, but called for civil damages against the newspaper, against the individual, et cetera, et cetera. And subsequently, you know, he wanted everybody involved in this put in prison and sued. The state has forged ahead like a runaway meat wagon against the story. But even though the story itself was spiked until they had notified the state and let them fix the problem, and as Professor Khan said, it's not hacking if you look at unencrypted source code on a public website. How many of those words did you not understand, Governor? He didn't say that either, but, you know, that's me. Anyway, I talked about this last week because it seemed more and more like the governor really doesn't seem to understand what's going on, understand hacking, and actually maybe should get some advice before proceeding. But hey, that's politics. And it sounds to me more and more like the governor's got a bone to pick with the newspaper. Proofpoint provided evidence that a cybercrime group was using Squid Game to spread Drydex malware. The group, which is a large operation called TA575, has been sending emails claiming to be an employee of the Squid Game show and offering a whole bunch of different fun things, like allowing people access to new episodes of the show prior to release, offering to let them be on the show as a guest star, offering maybe to let them play in a real Squid Game. I'm not sure. I'm sure somebody's thinking about real Squid Games already. Proofpoint said that thousands of email lures were being sent to a variety of industries in the United States, among others, offering people opportunity to be in the show next season. I mean, none of this is news. You know, this is not really news to me. I mean, it's not revolutionary, but I did think I would mention it. All these requested forms that are attached to the emails, of course, are Excel macros, which if you run them, they download Drydex. Drydex was originally a banking Trojan, but now it's sort of expanded to do all sorts of stuff. And the downloads come from Discord URLs. So, you know, definitely keep that in mind. Yeah. And finally, remember Clippy? You may not, because you may be too young. But Clippy was that paperclip that popped up all the time in Word back in the 90s. It was this Microsoft thing. They put it in. It was so hard to get rid of. Every time you thought it was dead, it would pop back up. I mean, you know, you want to understand hate hacking. Well, that thing drove everybody right off the edge of the world. You're trying to type your dissertation and, "Hi, I'm Clippy. Would you like some help typing those words?" Like, "No, Clippy, go away." I did offer extra credit in my class to anyone who could write a piece of malware that would twist Clippy into a snarl of tangled metal and regret. Well, apparently now there are animated Clippy images in Microsoft Teams. Microsoft's been threatening animated emoji for a while, but they aren't quite there yet. And if they do, pretty soon your desktop's going to look like one of those scenes in Total Recall, if you haven't seen that episode, and nobody really wants it. It's like, you know, allowing people to do calls on the airplane so you can sit there for 8 hours listening to this guy. "Well, I don't know, Ted, but those TPS reports aren't going to sign themselves. You know what I was saying the other day to Vic? Vic, I said, let me tell you." You know, those guys, yeah, exactly. Especially the ones that hold their phone like this. Anyway, no one wants Clippy either. Poor, sad Clippy was sent to the island of unwanted emojis to sit around the slow fire and regret their life a long time ago. But now there are Clippy stickers. If you really must, you can go to the small icons underneath the chat window, and it's Clippy. Incidentally, the best student project I got from this was called Virtual Hell Pliers. It didn't work very well, but I really enjoyed the funny name, and they got a lot of extra credit for that. And that's a news wrap-up for the week of 31 October 2021. We'll see you next week on the Security Weekly News.